Water's a great mix of music. Right now, it's more from Morning Edition.
Good morning. More than 80 people are dead after flash flooding in Texas over the weekend. Texas Congressman Joaquin Castro explains how federal aid helps communities after floods killed 13 people in his district last month. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. After President Trump raised tariffs, he quickly paused, most of them giving countries time to make deals. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Almost 90 days later, there aren't many deals, and the tariffs have been delayed again. Also, more women are deciding to have fewer children. The world has never seen this kind of population decline that many researchers now say is inevitable. It's Monday, July 7th. On this day in 1946, Frances Cabrini became the first U.S. citizen to be canonized as a saint by the Roman Catholic Church. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. The difficult mission of search and recovery is happening in Texas for those swept away in disastrous flash floods on the 4th of July. 82 people are dead, mostly in Kerr County. Others are missing. The victims include children who were away at summer camp. Houston Public Media's Dominic Anthony Walsh reports the community there is close-knit.
Kerr County is home to just over 50,000 people, but the rolling hills draw visitors from across the state for camping, hiking, and tubing on the Guadalupe River, especially on holidays. Donnie Moser drove in from Houston on Wednesday. By Friday, he was trapped in his Airbnb without food and water, but local residents offered him shelter.
This is an incredibly, incredibly sad situation, but the way people just kind of took us in and helped us and it just made us part of their family, it's just amazing.
He says it reminds him of how residents in Houston come together after hurricanes. I'm Dominic Anthony Walsh in Kerrville, Texas.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will meet with President Trump at the White House today. The Trump administration has been trying to work toward a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports.
Trump says a deal could be reached this week in regards to Israel's war in Gaza, which has ramped up in recent days. He also said he and Netanyahu will speak about a, quote, permanent deal with Iran, which comes weeks after Israel struck Iran, starting a conflict that the U.S. waded into when it hit three Iranian nuclear sites. The meeting will be Netanyahu's third visit to the White House since Trump came back into office. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News.
The major Republican tax and spending cut bill is now law after President Trump signed it over the holiday. NPR's Luke Garrett reports many Republicans are celebrating Trump's significant legislative victory, while some economists are beginning to worry now about its consequences.
House Speaker Mike Johnson says President Trump's legislative agenda will put more money in people's pockets. Here he is on Fox News Sunday.
If you make between $30,000 and $80,000 a year, you're going to have a 15% less federal tax rate.
But Yale Budget Lab Executive Director Martha Gimbel tells NPR the bill is regressive and expensive. She says it's especially bad for the annual budget of an average low-income earner.
And if you're in the bottom quintile, once SNAP and Medicaid cuts are taken into account on average, you're losing $560.
Gimbel says the bill helps upper and middle class workers the most through large tax cuts and the no tax on tips and overtime policies. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
At this hour on Wall Street, U.S. stock futures are all trading lower. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Dinosaurs were rampaging through movie theaters this weekend. NPR's Bob Mondello has details.
Jurassic World Rebirth.
Please don't say they're raptors. They're raptors.
Will stomp its way to $147 million in its first 5 days in North America.
The Mosasaurus.
We found it?
No, it found us.
That's enough to make it the second biggest U.S. opening of 2025 after the Minecraft movie, but it's the weakest Jurassic World movie so far. Previous three didn't have the advantage of a long holiday weekend and ranged from $145 to $208 million in 3 days, not five.
Don't see that every day.
Or ever.
That said, Jurassic World Rebirth is playing well overseas. Its worldwide total this weekend is $318 million, the biggest global haul for any movie in 2025. Bob Mondello, NPR News.
The running of the bulls is underway in Pamplona, Spain. A stampede of bulls opened the festival today, pounding along cobblestone streets with thousands of runners. Spectators who prefer to be on the sidelines are watching from behind street barricades and up on balconies. Animal rights activists are there too, marching through the city, wearing horns and waving protest signs. Spanish media reports a few injuries so far. Suriname will have its first woman president. The South American country's parliament elected Jennifer Geerlings-Simons on Sunday. She is a doctor who ran unopposed after her party formed a coalition to oust the current president following a May election with no clear winner. Geerlings-Simons, who's 71, says she'll focus on the economy. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
The Vietnam veterans were committing suicide something like 19 per day. I don't think that suicide rate has dropped with the newer veterans.
This is Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served, a series exploring the challenges Minnesota's veterans face, as well as the opportunities and services available to them.
My name is David Hansen. I was in the United States Air Force. I went to Vietnam for a year in 69. I almost committed suicide. I had three attempts at suicide. Two of them I never told my wife. I sat on the kitchen floor. I had that knife in my hand. I couldn't face the fact of my wife waking up and finding me dead on the kitchen floor. I happened to see my wife's computer on the counter. I opened it up and I looked for the suicide hotline. The thought of suicide is not that it's just harming yourself, it's harming everybody else you leave behind. What are those people going to do without you?
Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served is produced by AMPERS with support from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, providing our veterans with help. Veterans can find that help online at minnesotaveteran.org.
Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. In Central Texas, crews are continuing the search for victims of last week's flash flooding.
At least 82 people died, with 68 of the deaths in Kerr County. Kerr County Sheriff says 28 of those deaths were children. Many of them were staying in youth camps on the banks of the Guadalupe River. In the days since the storm, local officials have been dealing with tough questions about why children in the camps and others who live along the river were not warned to evacuate.
NPR's Greg Allen is with us now from Kerrville. Greg, good morning.
Good morning.
So first, let's just talk about the ongoing search for victims. What are some of the obstacles facing rescuers?
Well, you know, Michelle, it's a very difficult environment for recovery crews here. I spent some time along the Guadalupe River yesterday and just saw horrific scenes. You know, the river rose 26 feet in just 45 minutes early Friday morning. And when it did, it swept trees, cars, and houses into the flood and carried them downstream. I saw cars piled up in trees, huge mounds of rubble and debris that were left by the river. Now, crews are going to have to sort through all that stuff to look for victims, and there's still about 30 victims, adults and children, who've not been identified.
Look, I know this is a difficult thing to talk about right now, but why didn't local officials warn people along the river to evacuate?
Well, it's a question that keeps coming up repeatedly since Friday. You know, some of the people who are asking it are the people who live in that area down by the river. I talked to Wendy Barker yesterday. She lives in Hunt, which is a community that was just devastated by the flooding. Barker's home is high enough that she wasn't flooded, but she wonders why she and others in the community never received any alerts.
I woke up multiple times during the middle of the night, heard it raining, but never got any warnings on our phone about any flash flooding or anything like that. I did not personally, from the weather service or anybody. But we didn't get those until later on in the morning.
The National Weather Service did begin warning of the potential for flooding on Wednesday and upgraded it on Thursday. The declaration of a deadly flash flood emergency didn't go out until nearly a foot of rain fell, which wasn't until the early morning hours on Friday. The question is, what did local emergency managers do with all that information?
So what are local officials saying?
Well, they say the focus now should be on recovery, and the questions about why alerts didn't go out and why evacuations weren't ordered should wait for later. But at a briefing yesterday, Kerrville City Manager Dalton Rice got repeated questions about it, and he became defensive.
And so as we were, preparing for it, unfortunately, the rain hit at the most inopportune time and right in the most inopportune areas where the North and South Fork hit. It converged, and so here we are. So again, we want to continue to focus on those rescue operations, and at that, we're not taking any more questions. Thank you.
Okay, Greg, you've done a lot of reporting on the growing threat of inland flooding related to tropical systems. So tell us, why is it happening?
Well, the rain bomb that fell on Kerr County was fueled by the remnants of Tropical Storm Barry, which hit Mexico last week and then curved up into Texas. It's the kind of thing we also saw last year when Helene weakened from being a hurricane, but then dumped as much as 30 inches of rain over parts of Tennessee and North Carolina. Now, these are areas where people are familiar with flash flooding, so much so that they sometimes call it nuisance flooding. Texas Governor Greg Abbott talked about it yesterday.
There's the potential for flash flooding, but there's no expectation of a water wall of almost 30 feet high.
What we've been seeing in recent years is more and more of these big rain events and deaths from freshwater flooding. One factor is climate change, which scientists say is making tropical systems larger and wetter. It's a challenge for emergency managers and also for people who live in areas where rivers sometimes flood. The question is how to stay alert for flash floods that can quickly become deadly and how to get residents to do the same thing.
That is NPR's Greg Allen in Kerrville, Texas. Greg, thank you.
You're welcome.
To understand what Kerrville County needs in the face of this tragedy, we turn now to Democratic Congressman Joaquin Castro. His district is still recovering from flash flooding last month in San Antonio that took 13 lives. Now, some 100 miles away, more lives were swept away when storms dumped rain and caused this flash flooding, as we heard. And Congressman Castro knows about the desperation in the face of tragedy like this from experience. Congressman, thank you for joining us at this difficult time.
It's good to be with you. It's been an absolute tragedy for San Antonio a few weeks ago because we lost 13 people to flash floods, and now for the people of Kerr County to lose so many people in one terrible event like this.
Looking at this, I know that your district is still recovering from the flash floods last month and now this tragedy. What do you know about what Kerrville County will need most right now?
Well, a lot of support from local, state, and federal government. And, of course, all of the donations. And it's been amazing to see just the level of support that's come from people really all over the world for Kerr County and the people who are suffering there. And so I know that they have posted about exactly what they need. But it's going to take the community a long time to recover there.
Just as they did in San Antonio last month, hundreds of first responders have conducted water rescues. They're saving people who are stranded in trees and stuck in swamped vehicles. Are there enough local resources available to recover from disasters like this?
Kerr County is not the size of Bexar County where San Antonio is or Harris County like Houston. And so the tax base there is much more limited. It's a smaller community. So especially in places like that, that's where you need to lean on the resources of a state government and a federal government. So it's going to be important that both state and federal governments are very helpful and supportive with resources, with money for the community to rebuild, to look at alarm systems to prevent this from happening again, to look at flood mitigation efforts as well. It's tragic in both cases. In both cases, in San Antonio and in Kerr County, were very different. In Kerr County, you had a situation where the river rose and you had structures, housing along the river. In San Antonio, it was a very urban situation where people were basically trapped in their vehicles with rising water in a flash flood very quickly. But it really speaks to the importance of having the resources, including the National Weather Service, to be able to warn people very quickly and move very quickly to combat flash flooding.
One of the big questions being posed to local officials, to state officials, and to the White House is why people weren't warned earlier. Some of your colleagues in the Senate sent a letter to the president and the Secretary of Commerce last month, alarmed over the staff reductions at the National Weather Service and what that could mean for emergency preparedness. In your view, did these cuts play a role in preparations and warnings here?
I mean, I think it's too early to know whether in this particular instance it did, but I think there should be a full investigation, not just of any kind of federal failures, but also state and local, obviously. I think you owe that. We all owe that to the community there. And also, I think we owe that to the people of this country going forward to make sure that we do everything we can to prevent something like this from happening again. But I think it also speaks to the importance of the National Weather Service, that you have a full and robust staff that can work with state and local agencies to warn people. Because most of all, you see that you're dealing with just a short period of time with a flash flood where you got to get the message out to people right away. That means you need the personnel in place. You need the local governments helping to warn people. And then you need a way to help people evacuate very quickly. And, you know, right now we still have a rescue effort going on, and finding the rest of those people alive, hopefully, is the priority. But, you know, after that, in the months to come, I think we owe it to everybody to make sure that there's a thorough investigation of what went wrong.
President Trump last night said he would sign a disaster declaration for the flood zone. What will the federal support do?
Well, I think it'll be a lifeline, again, for a small community that on its own doesn't have a huge tax base. And so that's where you need a federal government to lean in and to be helpful. And so hopefully there will be that alarm system put in place. There'll be flood mitigation efforts for the future. You know, there will be obviously help with items that the community needs and the families need that have been affected. So that federal help is going to be incredibly important.
You know, I know, Congressman, that this wasn't in your district, but this tragedy seems very far-reaching. I mean, I know my sister's a teacher. There were parents at her school looking for their child. I mean, how far-reaching has this been? This tragedy been across Texas and really across the country?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Guadalupe River and the area there around Hunt, Texas, and in Kerr County, it's a popular place for people to go to camp from different parts of Texas, different parts of the country. But people also, you have people who have homes there, vacation homes, some of them, folks that go camping there. Remember, this was around the 4th of July. And so it has been incredibly, incredibly wide-ranging in terms of the people who were affected and where they're from.
As you know, we're beginning to experience heavier and more extreme rainfalls. I mean, what most needs to happen now to try to prevent future loss of life in these weather emergencies?
We need a strong National Weather Service. We need to strengthen the working relationship between the National Weather Service and state and local governments. We need to improve the warning systems, obviously. And, you know, I know that for many years now, the idea of climate change has become a political one. You know, it's become a very political debate. But these events that were supposed to be a 1-in-100-year event or 1-in-500-year event have been happening more often. And, you know, so we have to take that issue seriously and combat it.
Democratic Congressman Joaquin Castro of Texas, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It is 6:19. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7:20, Sarah Bignall and I will present Events Up North, a closer look at the events going on this week throughout northern Minnesota. You can also find that list right now at our website, kaxe.org. Support for KAXE comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. We also thank Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. Kutaska Community Action has a Big View discussion tomorrow at Community Presbyterian Church in Grand Rapids. The topic is defining allyship. Lunch begins at 11:30. Conversation to follow. Registration required. Email alicem@kutaska.org. Pequot Lakes Community Theater presents Roald Dahl's Willy Wonka starting this Friday at Pequot Lakes High School Theater, going through July 20th. Friday shows at 7 o'clock. Saturday, Sunday shows at 2 p.m. You can let us know about events going on in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. We continue with Morning Edition on KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Maiden, makers of cookware found in restaurants around the world, offering a carbon steel nonstick griddle for home use. Designed for use indoors or outdoors on a grill or over an open flame. More at maiden.com. From the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From Workday, Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Our next story is about something that seems personal and deeply private, and it is, but it's also something that has huge implications for economies and cultures. It's about the decision to have kids. It turns out that people all over the world are choosing to have a lot fewer babies. In many countries, including the U.S., there aren't enough children being born to maintain a stable population. NPR's Brian Mann and Sarah McCammon have been looking into why this dramatic change is happening.
When we first started looking at the data showing this massive drop in the number of babies being born around the world, Brian and I were both a bit confused.
Yeah, remember, the big fear back in the 1960s and 70s was people having too many kids.
No intelligent, patriotic American family ought to have more than two children, preferably one. If you're
That's Paul Ehrlich, a famous scientist. He warned of a population bomb during that 1970 interview on WOI-TV. He called for a government campaign to convince Americans big families are dangerous.
You get a scene which shows Los Angeles in the smog, and it just says this city has a fatal disease. It's called overpopulation.
But now, all these decades later, things have changed so dramatically. It is baffling and alarming many of the experts who study this.
We're actually really facing the question of depopulation.
Melissa Carney is an economist. She studies population trends at the University of Notre Dame.
All over the world, especially in high-income countries, the birth rate has very quickly plummeted in a sustained way.
If you're listening to this story in a traffic jam or on a crowded subway, you know, fewer people might actually sound like a really good thing.
But people studying this trend say it's accelerating, and they think all kinds of things could start to unravel as populations rapidly age and shrink. In many countries, it's already harder to find young workers. Innovation and demand for goods could stagnate. Pension and social security programs could buckle.
Now, the truth is, economists don't know for sure how all of this will play out. The world has never seen the kind of population decline that many researchers say is now inevitable. But Carney thinks it'll be huge.
This demographic issue is poised to potentially remake so much of our society in a way that people just don't seem to be thinking about.
Women around the world and here in the U.S. are having roughly half as many children on average compared to women in the 1960s. That's according to data from the United Nations and the Federal Reserve. And here again, researchers aren't sure why.
Some experts think maybe it's a question of affordability, the rising cost of raising children. Others point to things like social isolation, fears about the planet's future.
But one leading theory is that this is really happening because of something most of us would consider positive. Lots of young people, especially women, just have more freedom and economic independence, and they're making very different decisions about their lives.
Hello, I'm Ben.
I'm Sarah.
Sarah and Ben Brewington live in Los Angeles. They're both 35 years old.
Been together since high school?
Mm-hmm. We started dating senior year.
After getting married, they moved to LA, and they kind of did everything you'd expect from a young couple. They built good careers, they bought a cute house with a garden.
This year is probably our best year of tomatoes. Normally, we don't get enough to try to make.
And Sarah told us for years, they assumed their next step would be kids. It just seemed like the normal thing to do.
And then I started thinking, what do I want?
So they held off for a year, then another year. And they were surprised by the gradual discovery that children were just not part of the plan anymore.
It's a resounding no. Like, it's, you know, it's not something that I'm interested in or want.
I don't feel guilty about it at all now to say, like, I don't want kids.
And here's the thing. Researchers say what Ben and Sarah are doing, having fewer babies or opting out of parenting altogether, this is becoming more and more common.
What's interesting about the United States is we're sort of a latecomer to this game.
That's Philip Levine. He studies population trends at Wellesley College. We called him to help us think through the scale of this change and what it means.
In the rest of the developed world, in high-income countries, the birth rate's been falling for decades.
And Levine gave us a really simple way to think about all this. He uses a number that researchers call the total fertility rate.
Total fertility, that is a technical term, of course, but it's used by scientists to predict something important. The number of babies each woman will have over her lifetime. And for a population to remain stable, so we're talking just flat, no growth, no decline, every woman would need to have an average of 2.1 kids.
So you need to replace yourself, you need to replace a partner, and you need a little extra for mortality.
But here in the U.S., the total fertility rate has been dipping below that 2.1 line for decades. And after 2007, the number of births per woman began plunging. In 2023 and 2024, the U.S. hit record lows of 1.6. Levine says the U.S. is actually doing better than most developed countries.
We're at 1.6, which we're worried about at 1.6. South Korea is at 0.7. There's just, relatively speaking, no children being born in South Korea.
And South Korea is not alone. A United Nations study published last month found more than 1 in 10 countries now have what researchers think of as hyper-low fertility.
Again, there's a debate about why this is happening. But Levine agrees the biggest single factor may just be growing freedom.
You know, you have more choices in life today than you used to. And there's a whole host of options that doesn't involve having children.
Which brings us back to Ben and Sarah Brewington, the couple in LA. They told us they're aware that personal choices like theirs about kids and parenting could reshape the world.
I know that there definitely is, like, there is going to come a time where, like, everyone's retiring and there's not going to be a workforce.
But here's the challenge. Younger adults we've been talking to, including Sarah Brewington, say convincing them to have more children won't be easy.
It feels unethical to tell people to go through a grueling process because you want to have another baby in the world.
But governments around the world are searching for ways to boost the number of babies being born. It's happening in progressive countries like France and Sweden. It's happening in authoritarian places like China and Russia. And it's happening here in the U.S.
Later on All Things Considered, we'll look at the politics and the right-wing populism that's shaping America's debate over fertility, population, and family. I'm Sarah McCammon.
And I'm Brian Mann, NPR News.
NPR's Liz Baker contributed to this reporting from Los Angeles. This is NPR News.
When Vice President Kamala Harris took over the Democratic ticket last summer, top Biden campaign staff remained in place.
Now, a lot of Harris aides think that was actually a fundamental flaw because the people who were driving the process were not her people.
A new book reveals the tensions between Harris and President Biden and how it led to the Democrats' failure in 2024. On the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
All things considered, coming up at 4 o'clock here on People Powered KAXE with your local host, Andrew DeZingle. Good morning. It is 6:29. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on KAXE. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have Minnesota Native News, and Laura Erickson will be speaking for the Birds. Support comes from Edward Jones financial advisor Christina Gallis, helping individuals and business owners reach their financial goals. More information at edwardjones.com. Edward Jones, member SIPC. Let's take a look at current temperatures. We've got a range of 53 in Hibbing and Aiken, 61 in Bemidji, the warm spot, 60 in Park Rapids, 55 in Grand Rapids, 57 in Brainerd. For today, we do have a chance of showers and thunderstorms, mainly late this afternoon, increasing clouds throughout the day, highs near 80, southeast winds around 5 miles per hour. For tonight, showers and thunderstorms likely, lows 54 to 58, and tomorrow, gradually clearing, highs 76 to 80, slight chance for showers. Our lows tomorrow night in the mid to upper 50s, and looking ahead to Wednesday, mostly sunny, highs 78 to 82. The Bemidji Senior Center invites you to their Oodles of Noodles and Yankee Doodles fundraiser tonight, 6 o'clock. Enjoy a spaghetti dinner followed by a patriotic concert by the First City Singers. Right now, it is time for Minnesota Native News.
This is Minnesota Native News. I'm Murray Rock. This spring, the Minnesota Supreme Court heard arguments challenging the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act, or MIFPA. Reporter Emma Needham has more.
The first case is in the matter of the welfare of the children of...
Shortly after their birth in 2022, twin toddlers from the Red Lake Nation were placed in foster care by Child Protection Services. Due to their status as Indian children, the twins' case is subject to law called the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act, or MIFPA, which is designed to keep Native American children in the care of their relatives and connected to their tribal community during child protection proceedings.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, M. Boulette, representing the guardian ad litem and arguing today on behalf of all respondents.
Over a year after placement, the twins' foster parents were informed that the Red Lake Nation, Faribault County, and Martin County supported placing the children with their direct relative instead, who is a tribal member. They filed a motion in court, arguing that the law discriminated against them based on their race, raising constitutional questions about MIFPA and the Federal Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA. Here's the legal counsel for the foster family, Jeff Markowitz, on April 1st at the Minnesota Supreme Court.
For this court to declare ICWA and MIFPA unconstitutional, it would say no longer will people be discriminated at the courthouse doors and told they must go into a certain column based on whether or not they are Indian.
Associate Justice Ann McCreig challenged this idea.
I mean, she's a blood relative. Nobody can object to that. Why is that discriminatory?
ICWA and MIFPA support Native sovereignty by prioritizing placement with approved relatives of Indigenous children. M. Boulette, counsel for the guardian ad litem, also argued on behalf of the Red Lake Nation and both Minnesota counties.
There is no sense in which ICWA and MIFPA have been applied to appellant's benefit or detriment, and so this is not a case to invalidate decades of child protection law, protecting tribal members and tribal-eligible members.
Boulette says there's no way to predict when the court will make a decision. Earlier in 2024, Minnesota courts upheld the twins' placement, and in 2022, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the Federal Indian Child Welfare Act with a 7-2 majority. A decision is expected later this year. When it arrives, the Minnesota Supreme Court's ruling could significantly impact child welfare law and the children it protects. For Minnesota Native News, this is Emma Needham.
Next, the proposed Safeguard American Voter Eligibility, or SAVE Act, passed in the U.S. House in April, now awaits Senate hearings. It's raising concerns about voting rights across the country. Here's an update on the proposed legislation with reporter Deanna Standing Cloud.
Minnesotans take great pride in our elections, and I never miss a chance to say that we are most often number one in the nation in voter turnout.
Minnesota Secretary of State Steve Simon testified this May against the SAVE Act.
The legislation would, if enacted, keep millions of eligible Americans from the polls. It would cost states, counties, and cities in Minnesota, at least, untold millions of dollars to implement, and it would impose the risk of criminal prosecution for local election workers.
Proponents of the SAVE Act say that the law will ensure that only U.S. citizens vote in elections. However, it is already illegal for non-citizens to vote in federal elections. The SAVE Act awaits consideration in the U.S. Senate.
Now, I've been speaking out on this topic for some time, and I am not alone. My colleagues from across the country have also been sounding the alarm about the SAVE Act.
One of those colleagues is O.J. Siemens, co-executive director of Four Directions Native Vote. In a recent statement, Siemens said, "The Safeguard American Voter Eligibility, SAVE Act, currently in Congress is highly dangerous legislation. The requirements within the bill would annihilate the Native vote turnout all across America." For Minnesota Native News, I'm Deanna Standing Cloud.
Minnesota Native News is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.
You can find more at minnesotanativenews.org. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Sarah Bignall will be joining me in the 7 o'clock hour, and we'll bring you events up north at 7:20. We'll also hear a rebroadcast of Tammy Bobrowski's What We're Reading conversation with Kent Nerburn on his new novel, Lone Dog Road. Coming up at 9 o'clock this morning, Headwaters with Heather Johnson. It's Monday, which means it's request line day. At 10:30, she's going to play a set of music with songs featuring yodeling. She would love your suggestions. Text 218-326-1234. You can also answer our question of the week. We want to know what you like to do in or on the water in the summertime. Again, you can text us 218-326-1234. Support comes from Hibbing Chrysler Center, serving the Northland for over 25 years on the Beltline in Hibbing. Their service center provides regular maintenance and major auto repairs weekdays from 7:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. More details online at hibbingchrysler.us. We also thank Hot Tubs of Northern Minnesota on Middle School Avenue in Bemidji, offering hot tubs, pool tables, saunas, and more. Learn more online at hottubsmn.com. Up next, we're going to hear from Laura Erickson speaking for the birds.
For Christmas 1974, my mother-in-law gave me my first pair of binoculars and my first Peterson Field Guide. I read it cover to cover and then read the Golden Guide cover to cover. The Peterson Guide was great, but the text was separate from the plates. Many of the plates were still black and white, and there were no range maps. Also, the Peterson plates showed nothing but the birds, usually in profile against a monochrome background. The Golden Guide illustrations gave hints about habitat and different ways the birds might be seen. The Peterson Guide showed the three eastern chickadees, black-capped Carolina and brown-capped, now boreal, in exactly the same profile with the exact same light blue background. The Golden Guide showed them and the four other North American chickadees in different poses, which primed me to recognize how chickadees of any species might cling to a narrow branch upside down. It showed them with a background of deciduous leaves for the black-capped and Carolina chickadees and coniferous branch backgrounds for the others, suggesting both habitat and the fact that chickadees were not likely to be seen on the ground. Also, the Golden Guide had all the illustrations on the right-hand page facing the information and range map for each bird. In every way, it was more user-friendly, so it became the book I took with me everywhere, starting the day I set out on my first birding adventure, March 2, 1975. My technique at first was to rifle through every page of the book, starting with the loons, stick my finger in a page where I first found a bird resembling the one I was looking at, and then continue through to the end of the book just in case there were others that resembled it too. I spent several long minutes puzzling over my very first bird, which proved to be a black-capped chickadee. My real-life bird affirmed the different poses shown by the illustrated chickadees, but when I continued to the end of the book, I was momentarily stymied by the black poll warbler, who also has a black cap and white cheeks, though its white throat and streaked back quickly took it out of contention. Had the chickadee been overhead rather than at eye level, I'd also have had to eliminate the golden-winged warbler, which also has white cheeks and a black bib. But the golden yellow crown and wings shown on the Golden Guide illustration instantly eliminated that one, and I never noticed the resemblance until several years later when a golden-winged warbler at treetop height momentarily looked exactly like chickadee from beneath. Throughout the spring and summer of 1975, I rifled through every page of my guide every time I saw a new or confusing bird. And as I grew more and more familiar with both birds and the field guide, I could much more quickly zoom in on my bird. Still, I double-checked not just every new bird, but also birds I'd already seen that might be in a different plumage or still confused me. My golden guide was my constant companion all that year and the next year when the pages started falling out. At first, I tried to tape them in, but it was hopeless. Dozens of birders told me that they'd experienced the same thing with their golden guides. I bought a second copy in 1977, the year I started teaching. That's when I discovered that the falling out pages were a feature, not a bug. Because the drawings were all on right side pages, I could cut them out and glue them to index cards to create flashcards. Whenever we saw a bird on a class field trip or a student asked about a species, I'd make a flashcard to post on our bulletin board. That winter, I made flashcards of all the warblers for myself, which I reviewed before every spring migration until I had them down cold. I hardly ever use those old flashcards anymore, and in some cases the glue dried up and no longer holds the pictures to the cards, but I've kept them all these years. I don't usually study with flashcards before trips anymore, but this year I created a set before Russ's and my Hawaii trip. In the weeks before we left, we'd run through them once or twice a day, an invaluable exercise for familiarizing Russ with what were virtually all new birds, and a good way for me to brush up on them too. To make these flashcards, I used illustrations from Cornell's Birds of the World website, and this time around, rather than using glue, I laminated them. I've never used any field guide as heavily and regularly as I did my treasured first golden guide, both before and after the pages fell out. My copy may be half a century old now, but it's still younger than I am, and I still treasure it. I'm Laura Erickson, speaking for the birds.
You can find more at lauraerickson.com. It is 6:43. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. The Buck Lake Improvement Club has their monthly breakfast buffet this Sunday, July 13th from 9 to noon at the Buck Lake Community Center, located 12 miles north of Nashwauk on Highway 65. And Watermark Art Center in Bemidji has an open call for their 20th annual It's Only Clay competition and exhibition. Applications are due by August 31st. Find complete information at watermarkartcenter.org. At KAXE Local Matters, and we bring you updates on news and events relative to our rural communities. We do this because we live here too. Federal funding helps make this kind of local coverage possible, and that is at risk right now. Visit protectmypublicmedia.org to share what KAXE brings to our community. Thank you so much for your support, and thank you for listening. Ahead, we will have more news from National Public Radio's Morning Edition, and just after 7 o'clock, we'll have a special edition of the Up North Report. Megan Buffington looking at what is legal and illegal when it comes to fireworks. Thanks for listening to KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Good morning. Today marks 6 months since deadly wildfires hit Southern California. On January 7th, unusually strong Santa Ana winds turned parts of the Los Angeles area into an inferno. The two largest fires were in the Pacific Palisades and Altadena. 30 people were killed and more than 16,000 structures were destroyed. Steve Futterman went to one street in Altadena to see what it's like now.
The Reverend Jerry Wilson has been taking evening walks on Loma Alta Drive for years, and he loved it.
Laughter, life, horses everywhere, people walking their dogs, saying hi to your neighbors.
Once he returned to his home, though, after the fires and resumed his walks, he noticed a difference.
And then it was like someone dropped a bomb, and I don't know if you ever walked out after a snowfall and how you have that eerie silence. And so that's what it feels like.
On this slightly more than 2 mile stretch of Loma Alta, we found 22 homes still standing. Before the fire, there were more than 150.
Well, we had a 2,000 square foot house and a pool and had a car collection. We actually lost 10 cars at the night of the fire.
Ted Ancona remembers January 7th, how the fire quickly spread, how people panicked, and finally the desperation to escape. For those whose homes didn't burn, they still have difficulty talking about it, like Karen Kemmerer.
I think those of us that are here are grateful, but grieving.
You're grieving still.
Sorry, I didn't know I was going to cry. It's just such a mass area and so many homes. And for at least 2 miles east of us, maybe there's 5% of the homes that weren't burned.
Even for the homes still standing, it is virtually impossible to escape smoke damage. Richard Page experiences that every day.
It permeates everything, you know, just everything. Your skin, your clothes, every single thing that's... So this house is... You know, people come over and they go, oh, wow, you know, it's really pungent in here.
Assessing smoke damage has become a contentious issue for some whose homes are still standing and are trying to get relief from their insurance companies. Indeed, insurance is an issue for many.
The insurance company, they're like nickel and dime and you.
Lucio Rodriguez thinks his insurance company is making it difficult for him to collect. His home was destroyed.
Well, they're asking you how old was your clothes, how old were your underwear. They say, oh, you have pictures of your jewelry. It's like, I don't take pictures of stuff like that.
Rebuilding is not going to be quick or easy.
The people who are thinking that this is going to rebound in a year are woefully uninformed. It's just not how these things go.
Luke Melcher is a contractor. We met him in front of a home he is rebuilding on Loma Alta. He has dealt with this before. If we come back a year from now, what do you think we'll see?
On this particular street, you'd be lucky to see five houses built.
As I walked with Jerry Wilson, I asked if Loma Alta Drive will ever be the way it once was.
The truth of the matter is, it's never going to be the same. It's not going to be the same demographic. It's not going to be the same economics.
I did find one sound that has returned. On the nearby, mostly empty tennis courts on Loma Alta, a father and daughter were playing pickleball. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Altadena, California.
This is NPR News.
It is 10 minutes before 7 o'clock. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Atchison Tire in Grand Rapids, providing service and offering tire brands like Bridgestone, Firestone, and Toyo, serving the area since 1916. More at atchisontire.com. We also thank UPM Blend and Paper, integrating bio and forest industries into a sustainable and innovation-driven future. More information at upmpaper.com. Coming up just after 7 o'clock, we'll have a special edition of the Up North Report. You can find lots of local stories as well at kaxe.org. Taking a look at our current temperatures, we have a range of 55 in Hibbing up to 61 currently in Bemidji and Park Rapids, 57 in Grand Rapids, 59 in Brainerd. For today, chance of showers and thunderstorms, mainly late this afternoon, increasing clouds as we go throughout the day, highs near 80, southeast winds around 5 miles per hour. Showers and thunderstorms likely tonight with lows 54 to 58 and then gradually clearing tomorrow, highs 76 to 80 with a slight chance for showers. And looking ahead to Wednesday, mostly sunny, highs 78 to 82. You can answer our question of the week. What is your favorite thing to do in or on the water? Text 218-326-1234.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Horseback riding, epic canoe races, fried chicken every Sunday. Just some of the traditions at Camp Mystic, a summer camp for girls along the Guadalupe River in Central Texas. And now, a place of mourning, because children and staff were among the more than 80 people who died in flash flooding this weekend. With the exception of a few years during World War II, when it was a rehab center for GIs, girls have headed there every summer since 1926 to enjoy nature, make friends, and to deepen their faith. We wanted to hear more about what Camp Mystic has meant to so many people, so we called Lauren Garcia, and she was nice enough to agree to talk with us. She went to Camp Mystic for 10 years, first as a camper and then as a camp counselor, and she's with us now. Good morning, Lauren. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
I understand your mom and her sisters all went, and your sisters all went?
Yes.
What made it so special for all of you?
Oh, we loved it. It was a home to some of the most meaningful and lifelong friendships I've had. It's like a little slice of heaven there. Every summer to come back and see the familiar faces and fresh ones, I couldn't wait.
What are some of your favorite memories?
Yeah, I don't know where to start. I mean, it's rooted in tradition and ritual. Sundays were some of my favorites. We would all make our way down to the cool Guadalupe waterfront for our Sunday devotionals. You could hear everyone's charm bracelets would jingle as we'd all sing together. We would learn lessons from the camp owners themselves, Tweedy and Dick Eastland. They owned the camp, but it felt more like a family there. They knew everyone's names, and they would teach us things like how to be kind to one another. They would hand out these things called fuzzies to other little campers. We'd pass them to each other. They were like small, colorful pom-pom cotton balls, just to recognize how to give love to one another. And we'd also hear things from Tweedy Eastland on how to live life full of love and other fun tips like painting your nails red to stop the habit of biting them.
Right.
It was so special. family was involved in everything, from walking around the campgrounds, teaching us fishing. Their sons and daughters were program directors, head chef, head nurses. They ran the events, and they made the most amazing food. The rituals of just knowing on certain days you were getting coffee cake, and on Sundays you could expect the best fried chicken, the fluffiest biscuits, and you always would get vanilla with peanut butter to follow. It was just this reliable place of respite.
Why, you know, we've heard about so many, you know, famous and not famous people who sent their daughters there. I mean, Laura Bush, the former first lady, was a counselor there. It just, why do you think it has had such a hold on so many people through so many generations?
It's hard to put into words unless you are a mystic girl. I don't think there's words. No amount of anecdotes could allow me to explain now how this place has been cracked open for the world to see. It was like a little bubble and a safe haven. And no matter what was going on in your home life or your school life, you would come back each year and expect some of the same rituals and traditions. And I think that's things that girls like myself depended on. It brought calm and ease, and it was just beautiful there.
We only have about 30 seconds left. I can only imagine what you're feeling knowing about what happened at the flood. And I'm just wondering, what kinds of conversations are you having with other former campers? What are you talking about?
Yeah, my heart is broken. It was devastating for so many families. I can't even put that into words. I think this community needs each other. We are leaning on each other, on our faith and the love that we shared for this camp. And that's what Camp Mystic taught us, is to lean on each other. Physically, we're seeing people help out with recovery efforts and organizing massive donation drives. And for this unimaginable sorrow, we're staying connected through prayer and service. And that's always what camp has been about.
That is former Mystic camper, Lauren Garcia. Lauren, thank you.
Thank you.
30 college teams competed in a three-day race over the weekend to find the most efficient solar-powered cars. Michael Collins from member station WKYU in Bowling Green, Kentucky, checked out the competition.
At a typical racetrack, the crowds get drowned out by the engine noise. This is not your typical race. It's the 25th annual Electric Formula Sun Grand Prix in Bowling Green, Kentucky. The competition invites college teams from the U.S. and Canada to compete in an endurance race using custom-designed solar-powered cars. Not a gas can in sight.
It's kind of a beast. It's enormous, but it kind of whips around on the turns. We enjoy watching it drive.
That's Sam Woolsey with the Georgia Tech team. He's talking about their solar race car. It looks a bit like a cross between a family van and a spaceship. The roof is lined with solar panels, and it tops out around 55 miles an hour.
Right now, we're breaking boundaries. We're the first four-person American solar-powered car at this competition.
It's true. Most cars here are two-seaters, like the one from Appalachian State University, which looks more like a sports car, painted with the motto, "Running on Shine," a nod to the area's moonshine liquor history. Then there's a one-seater from the University of Illinois they call Calypso. Joao Feliciano is a freshman and one of its drivers. He hopes one day to work in robotics.
Because of the car, I started doing like machining. So I actually get to like learn more stuff than just solar car, because I get the opportunities from solar car, which have helped out so much.
Some of the innovations on these cars have made it into commercial ones, like regenerative braking that charges your battery when you push the brakes. Students like Feliciano say there's more to come from solar cars.
This can be the future. It's not an applicable future yet, but we're showing what is possible.
Even as clean energy incentives are going away, many here like Woolsey aren't worried about the future of the solar industry.
We're seeing a pullback in America for sure, but companies know like that momentum is not really gonna stop. It's maybe slowed a little bit, but if all goes normally in the next 4 years, we'll be back on track in good time.
In the end, the University of Illinois and Polytechnique Montreal teams won their respective races, all on nothing but shine. For NPR News, I'm Michael Collins in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
It is a minute before 7 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. If you click on that donate button, you'll see lots of options for becoming a member. You can set up sustaining gifts, which are ongoing monthly payments, or do a one-time gift. Thank you so much for your support. Coming up in just a few moments, we're going to have a special edition of the Up North Report. And at 7:20, it's Events Up North. Sarah Bignall and I will take a closer look at what's going on throughout the region this week. Support comes from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown